Right, you just gotta love, well, maybe not love, but it's fascinating to see all of this weird weather that's going on. It was super frigid and then super snowy and super warm, and I'm super scared for a lot of people who are downriver of a lot of this meltage that's happening. I was looking at that warm front that was moving through across the country, even as we speak. And if you're being affected by this weather, maybe you're even under a tornado watch as we speak. Then we'll be with you through the night and hopefully keeping you company while you keep an eye on what's happening. 65 degrees, I was seeing, is like some highs in the Midwest, 59 in Detroit or something. It's insane. Spawning tornadoes and massive meltdowns and lots of flooding alerts. And so as things change, just keep on listening to Coast AM, your local station. I'm sure will break in should there be anything that you absolutely need to hear about, and we'll be with you just to keep you company throughout the night. U.S. is getting this very weird rapid climate change, some people say, because of the global warming. The U.S. Geological Survey is just even put out a new report saying, if you think this is weird, the new assessment suggests that earlier projections may have underestimated the climatic shifts that could take place by the year 2100. So we won't be around for that by and large, unless some other, changes have been made in medicine that allow us to be here for that. But it will affect our kids and our grandkids. And we're talking about major sea level changes. They're suggesting a complete shift of the coastline of the United States, entire states like Florida facing a great reduction in their land mass. So that's just one aspect of these unusual winter storms that we should keep an eye on. Not saying it is happening for sure, and not saying that global warming is everything that it is touted to be, but gosh, just when you think you understand how the weather works, it seems to be shifting a lot these days. But that's just one of the stories we'll get to coming up when we do crypto news in just a minute. Got a big show ahead. Matt Savinar will join us for the first hour. Another interesting development here, predictions of great drops in oil prices for 2009. We'll have Matt Savinar address that a little bit later on, as he's a believer that that oil will peak, and I wonder whether those predictions have been changing. Also coming up next hour, the co-authors of a book series about leprechauns and gnomes. There's one in my hand called The Magic of Gnomes and Leprechauns. They're all about the natural people, and they will tell you how you can get in touch with them, the ones that are all around us, even as we speak. Where can they be found? How can you lure the magic people, the natural magic people, like leprechauns, gnomes, and elves, into your life? Coming up next hour. But first, the giant big black sludge that's swallowing the South is nothing compared to the homemade biohazards that are cooking in your neighbor's garage right now. Panthers and eyeless crypto worm snakes are on the prowl, and only candy canes can save us. When we do crypto news to get us all started on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Let's get crypto news started. Did you just hear me on the air? Do we getting Matt Savinar lined up here in just a second? The first hour here, I think we're gonna actually take some calls for Matt Savinar. I know there's a lot of interest in these oil prices. Have you heard the latest on that? We'll get to it at the end of crypto news this evening. The Apple computer was invented in a garage, as the Associated Press writes here. Same with the Google search engine. Now, tinkerers are working at home with the basic building blocks of life itself. In a story that appears on coasttocoastam.com, using homemade lab equipment and the wealth of scientific knowledge available online, hobbyists are trying to create new life forms through genetic engineering in their garages. A field long dominated by PhDs toiling in university and corporate laboratories. In her San Francisco dining room lab, for example, a 31-year-old computer programmer named Meredith Patterson is trying to develop genetically altered yogurt bacteria that will glow green to signal the presence of melamine, the chemical that turned Chinese-made baby formula and pet food deadly. I guess the good news is if the yogurt grows muscles and teeth and starts to march on Chicago, people in the Windy City will be able to see it coming in the dark. People can really work on projects for the good of humanity while learning about something they want to learn about in the process, she said. So far, no major gene splicing discoveries have come from anybody's kitchen or garage, but critics of this home genetic altering movement worry that these amateurs could one day unleash an environmental or medical disaster. Defenders say that the future Bill Gates of biotech, could be developing a cure for cancer in the garage. Can we just say those may not be mutually exclusive ideas? That doesn't I Am Legend start with the good news that a cure for cancer has been found just before it turned the whole planet into vampires? I don't know. You could have one and still get the other. Many of these amateurs may have studied biology in college but have no advanced degrees and are not earning a living in the biotech field. Some proudly call themselves biohackers. That's reassuring. Innovators who push technological boundaries and put the spread of knowledge before profits. I like that. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, a group called DIY Bio is setting up a community lab where the public could use chemicals and lab equipment, including a used freezer scored for free off Craigslist that drops to 80 degrees below zero, the temperature needed to keep many kinds of bacteria alive. Co-founder Mackenzie Cowell, a 24-year-old who majored in biology in college, said amateurs will probably pursue serious work such as new vaccines and super efficient biofuels, but they might also try, for example, to use squid genes to create tattoos that glow. Cowell said that such unfettered creativity could produce important discoveries. Quote, we should try to make science more sexy and more fun and more like a game, he said. Well, there you go. As long as you have the biohackers, probably not going to hurt anybody. And are just going to focus on having sexy fun with killer bacteria, I'll sleep just fine. How about you? I guess as long as I start every day with a shot glass of peppermint oil, I'll be fine. That is, new studies on peppermint, the key flavoring in traditional candy canes, reveals the herb may do everything from kill germs to treat digestive troubles. We heard about this last night. Two callers during open lines on Coast to Coast were touting the virtues of oregano oil, pure oregano oil, saying it cures cancer, it solves all sorts of problems, but they said that it tastes really bad. So, hey, pure peppermint oil, if it does the same thing, woohoo! Some researchers now advise consumers to eat a tablespoon or more of fresh peppermint and other green herbs daily. Peppermint oil found in most candy canes also appears to have health benefits. A British medical journal study led by McMaster University researcher Alex Ford concludes that peppermint oil should be the first line of defense against irritable bowel syndrome, a condition characterized by abdominal pain and irregular bowels that affects 5 to 20% of the population. So the peppermint oil may not fix your irritable bowel syndrome, but at least you'll smell better. And you never know when you might need to evade a predator. So that could come in handy. A recent report released by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Tampa shows sightings of Florida's endangered panthers are still rare, but close encounters with giant big cats are becoming more common. Now, this is important because there was a time when Florida panthers were considered extinct, but they never actually were extinct. People just stopped seeing them. The most common conflict is depredation, where a panther kills or tries to kill common livestock or pets. Biologists confirmed 10 incidents of depredation in which 11 animals were killed, including 5 goats, 5 sheep, and 1 fallow deer. A goat, a llama, and a dog had also been injured by panthers in Florida. 2 years ago, only 5 depredation incidents were reported. The year before that, there were none. So it's like doubling every couple of years. So if you do the math on that, you know, trend, who knows, in 2009 or 10, there'll be 20 Florida panther encounters, and then 40. And that's even before some biohacker makes a saber-toothed tiger in his garage in Boca Raton. So that could get interesting. Of course, it might come in handy when the giant eyeless worm snakes take over. The India News Service is reporting on December 25th that a new species of blind snake had been discovered for the very first time. It's a snake specimen with 25 rows of scales around its shiny dark brown body, found in a village in a distant district of India. Species, the large worm snake, has been pursued for years. Worm snakes are harmless blind species found mainly in Southeast Asia. They are burrowing reptiles that lead a secretive life because of the subterranean mode of existence. They are rarely seen and probably one of the reasons for little knowledge about their biology and ecology. Yeah, harmless now, but we're one biohacker test tube spill away from turning those blind snake worms into a sequel of the movie Tremors. And if these little-known creatures are real, why not Mongolian death worms? Do you know Mongolian death worms? A famous cryptid reported to exist in the Gobi Desert. It is described as a fat, bright red worm, 2 to 5 feet long. So not terribly different from what has already been discovered. The local name for it means blood-filled intestine worm, algoi, blood-filled intestine worm, because it is reported to look like the intestine of a cow. It is the subject of a number of extraordinary claims by Mongolian locals, such as the ability of the worm to spew forth sulfuric acid that, on contact, will turn anything it touches yellow and corroded, which would kill a human being, and is purported to be able to kill at a distance by means of an electrical charge. So it might actually be more like one of these snake worms, not a worm proper, but a snake worm, and having characteristics not unlike that of a gaboon viper or of an eel, an electric eel. Not out of the realm of possibility. We'll keep an eye on that. Who knows? Maybe you'll have a prediction about what they'll find in 2009. Art Bell's going to be doing the prediction show coming up on traditional the New Year's Eve show. Your predictions from last year, Art will go over some of those that did or did not come true, and then take new ones on Coast to Coast AM, and then I'll be on for George Norrie on New Year's Day night, and we'll be doing predictions from some of the more professional or more perhaps better known prognosticators about what's coming up in the new year. There is a new quote for where oil prices might go. According to a Wire story today, oil prices, which some people thought might hit $200 a barrel by the end of this year, might be under $25 a barrel in 2009, already plunging underneath $33 from time to time. Quote, we expect oil prices in early 2009 to remain under pressure, given the weakening demand outlook and as global economies continue to slow. That according to an analyst in London. By the end of the second quarter, we think oil prices will stabilize and find a floor, providing that OPEC can comply with their recent cuts and continue cutting output. But that's how bad it's gotten, that OPEC has to cut output in order to try to get the price to stop dropping. Matt Savinar is a guy who watches oil prices and is heard frequently on Coast to Coast AM. And Matt, any prediction on the future of oil prices in 2009 as you see it?
No. What I would like to say is last time I was on this show back in July with George, I said one of two things will happen. Either A, it'll go to $200 a barrel, or B, we're going to have a deflationary depression and it's going to shoot down to $40 a barrel. And that's pretty much exactly what's happened. As you know, because I've listened to the show on a pretty regular basis, the economy's come completely undone. We're looking at real unemployment rates of 16 or 17%. And that's why the price of oil has dropped.
And so then you don't want to make a prediction for 2009, but rest on.
I'll put it this way, Ian, I wouldn't be surprised if it falls to 20 and then whipsaws back up to 200. Because if you look at the latest report from the International Energy Agency, They say we're looking at a 9% yearly decline rate. That is going to cut supply in half in 8.5 years. Okay, with prices this low, there's not even an opportunity to even put in any sort of remedial measures, whether somebody thinks that's unconventional oil or solar or whatever, because none of those things, there's not going to be an investment capital necessary to even put in remedial measures when you've got oil at $20 or $40 a barrel. It has to go back up to 100 and stay over 100 for a significant period of time, like as in several years, for the investment world to get the idea that, oh, wow, we really do need to invest in this stuff. And again, not to toot my own horn, I said 6 months ago when I was on the show that we're not going to have smoothly functioning capital markets. And that's the exact phrase that I used. Once this all starts to unravel and you need smoothly functioning capital markets in addition to high energy prices to get the world to actually at least attempt to make a transition. But with prices this low, you've got all these projects, all whether it's unconventional oil or alternatives to oil, all of those are being shut down or greatly contracting because the investment money's dried up. So people, I would tell people, I know a lot of people are really happy that the price is back down low, and you know, I understand that, but all this is doing is serving to compound our problems. So on top of the depression that we've entered, and it really is a depression. I know people don't want to admit that.
I think we're past that. I think actually the government is now officially saying depression or recession, that doesn't seem to me to be too much of a controversy. But I mean, when the prices go up, so do the emails I get from peak oilers who say, aha, here it is. This is what the supplies are dwindling, and they're trying to get every penny they can for every barrel that's left. And then you watch at the end of this period, there'll be nothing left. And then the prices go down. And I'm not sure I understand how that reflects the actual quantity of oil that can be pumped.
Okay, there's two issues you just touched on. Number one is that most people, whether they think peak oil is real or not, if they've lived in America their whole life, they've been so dumbed down and their ability to think complexly has been reduced for a variety of reasons, from the way the education system conditions people to see things through a straw, to the fact that by the time somebody's 40, they've seen a million television commercials. So the brain doesn't have the ability to think in a complex fashion. So people think, I get the same emails. When the price goes up, they're like, oh my God, you're a prophet. Tell me what to do with my money. Then when the price drops down, they go, you're just an idiot, and I think you should get off the planet. And I've said the same thing for ages now, which is that you can have a plunging production or plateauing production, which you've had since 2004, and a low price at the same time, okay? Because if you've got a depression going on, the demand is going to drop a couple million barrels a day below the supply, and when you've got supply and demand really tight, it only takes a couple million barrels a day of a shortage or a couple million barrels a day of a windfall for the price to go through the ceiling and then to go back down. It's like if you were on a space plane, and let's say there's 100 people in that plane, or let's say 85 people in the plane, and the captain says, we've got enough oxygen for 87 people. Well, the price is going to be pretty reasonable because everybody perceives that there's enough to go around. If the captain comes on the radio and says, well, wow, there's 85 people on the plane. We only have enough oxygen for 83 people. That's the bad news. The good news is we're going to auction it off based on price. Well, what's going to happen to the price? It's not going to go up just a little bit. It's going to shoot through the ceiling. And then if people find out, oh, well, people are breathing a lot less because everybody's just sitting still, and the demand for oxygen goes down to what's, say, only 97% of what they were just using just a few minutes ago, then the price is going to plunge back down. Hopefully that explains it. And there was something else I was going to say, but I forgot, because there are two issues you touched on. People's inability to think complexly or think in a complex way, and then there was something else, but I don't remember what it was now.
We'll give the phone numbers here coming up after the bottom of the hour, and people can join in the conversation with Matt Savin, our first hour guest here, before we get to our main guest coming up next hour, who maintain that there are leprechauns, elves, and natural people, gnomes, for example, that are all around us. And how you can access them, how you can lure them, how you can prove to others that they do exist, coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. And then I'll share another story about oil prices coming up next, and we'll take a look at what oil prices might just do in 2009. Coming up next with Matt Savinar on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Looking at the short-term and the longer-term future of oil, lifeafterthedoilcrash.net is Matt Savinar's website, and he's also an attorney in California. We'll get back to the conversation then. And there was another story, obviously, about the effect on oil prices in 2009. That would be the swearing-in of Barack Obama, who has sworn in the past to fight oil speculators. He proposed legislation back in June to try to take the oil regulators out of the energy market. And there were a few oil energy speculators that did very well, obviously, in 2008, and some that ended up not doing well toward the end of the roller coaster ride of oil prices. And well, I'll ask Matt about that. Where will oil speculators be in the future? What role will they play in the prices as we're going to experience them? And then what's the current estimate for the number of years of oil that we have left on the planet, given current consumption? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. There are natural people all around us, say our guests coming up next hour. You just can't see them necessarily because they're constructed of light matter. We'll get to that coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. Matt Savinar is an attorney and the purveyor of lifeafterthedoilcrash.net. So coming in January, Barack Obama gets sworn in as president, and he's made it very clear he intends to limit the influence of oil speculators in the energy market. What kind of effect do you predict that might have in 2009, Matt? Have the oil speculators been exposed? Will they continue to control things?
Well, no, here's the thing. When oil was shooting from 70 up to 147, at each step of the way, there were just as many people betting or investing or speculating or whatever term you want to use. For every person who, when it was 100, who was betting that it was going to go to 120, there was one or two or three people betting that it was going to go down to 80. And those people, a lot of them, if they, depending on, you know, when they bought their contracts or what they did with their money, a lot of them lost a lot of money because they figured it would go down. This idea that the price went up because of speculation, what that is that's a sign of a culture that is addicted and doesn't want to come to grips with the fact that the party's over. So they start believing in all these sort of myths really irrational stuff. When you've got production had plateaued since the year 2004, yet demand continued to grow. When you have a commodity where production is flatlined, but demand for it, particularly from places like China, was shooting through the ceiling, of course the price is going to go up. Now, I'm not saying there wasn't some speculation or some shenanigans involved. There always is shenanigans involved. But if you look at the volatility of oil prices, even in other markets that aren't really, like tomatoes or whatnot, you see prices, you know, go up and go down and go up and go down. But you never hear anybody complaining about people speculating on tomatoes because we're not addicted to tomatoes the way we're addicted to oil.
Yeah, but it took the Enron crash for us to really see what they had been doing with California. It took the collapse of the company and then whistleblowers sort of doing a tell-all.
Well, like I said, I'm not saying that there's not shenanigans or speculation, but Ian, when you have a commodity, I'll repeat it because this is, like I said before, when people have trouble understanding complex ideas, I'll be honest with you, a lot of people have trouble understanding simple ideas, like the idea that in 2004, production had been growing steadily since the 80s. It plateaued from 2004 to 2008. But if the demand, if you've got people wanting more of it, the price is going to shoot up. Now, should it have shot up to 147? Maybe not. Maybe it should have shot up from about $30 in 2003 to maybe $100 or $120 or whatnot. But it's the idea that this is all speculation, that's again, like I said, that's an addicted culture that doesn't want to come to grips with reality. Now, when Barack says he wants to eliminate oil speculation, I would need to go and look through whatever it is he wants to do or whatever it is that he actually manages to get done to see what does that actually mean. Because whatever a politician says, they just say whatever is, particularly when they're racing to become president, they're going to say whatever resonates with people. And since people have lost the ability to think complex in a complex fashion, they're going to have to dumb it down. Okay, so I have to look at what Barack, if he wants to limit people's ability to invest thinking oil is going to go up or going to go down, well, if they can't invest thinking, gee, I think it's going to go up because the IEA just came out with a report saying we're looking at a 9% yearly decline rate, so I'm guessing that the price is going to go up, so I'll buy an oil contract or whatever you do with your money when you think that that's the case, then if you somehow eliminated people's ability to do that, that would, for one thing, that'd be akin to a command-style economy. The American people would welcome it, of course, because, you know, they look at cheap gas as a birthright, but then that would limit our ability to transition to anything else. If your goal is to keep, you know, gas prices at $1.50, then once the decline really gets underway, yeah, 6 or 9% or whatever it is, then we're screwed. We're dead in the water, and we're looking at a children of men type scenario.
I'm going to get to the phones here in just a second. You keep, it's about the third or fourth time you've talked about how stupid people are. So let me ask you to define that a little more clearly, because you, every time you say people, and you seem to imply everybody but you.
No, I don't mean so, everybody but me. But
okay, so I'm just asking you, as lawyers already have a reputation for thinking they're the smartest people in the room at any given moment, no matter who they're on.
So if you want to try to call my character into question.
No, I'm just saying. Matt, I'm just saying. So it's already a prejudice. I'm just saying, so fight that. Be more specific. Who are the people that you have faith in? That, I mean, because every time you say people, that's everybody. So who can get it? I mean, who's your hope for this to improve?
Well, I don't put my hope in anybody that I don't actually know personally. So, you know, if you're asking me to hope for, you ask me, well, hope in people that I don't know, that I've never met. I'll put it this way, Ian. What you said, or just as an example of what I'm talking about, every time I come on the show, whether it's you or George, everybody except for Art, you guys always ask me the same thing, which is what you asked right before the break, which is, well, when are we going to run out? How many years of recoverable oil are left? And I always explain it. It's at the very top of the front page of my site. I say it's not a matter of when we run out. It's a matter of when does production no longer able to grow.
Right.
And I've explained this to you and to George, you're unable to get it.
Matt, you don't want to do this. Don't. You're making an assumption here, and I don't want this to go this way. So don't throw me in the category of the dumb people. Let me just say, I threw that out there because it was at the top of the page of your website. You put it out as a rhetorical question on the top of your webpage, on your very own writing. Are we running out? I thought there were 40 years of the stuff left.
Right.
So I give you actually a fairly big softball for you to hit on that. I wish, prefer you wouldn't aim it at my groin.
Gotcha.
Let's get to...
You have to understand, my frustration is not even just with you guys, just with people. When you ask me about people, put it this way. You go up to 1,000 people and you ask them about peak oil, 995 of them have never heard of it. If you ask them about climate change, 50% think it's a liberal conspiracy, and 50% think they can deal with it through minor inconveniences. When if you've actually studied that issue, it's going to take a lot more than minor inconveniences. And it seems like we as a culture in general have, because we've been, our education system, it teaches people to think of energy in one topic, finance in another. So they have a really hard time understanding how the economy and energy interact. Or they have, like I said, by the average age of 40, the average person has seen a million television commercials, which conditions their brain to think of things in 20 and 30 second segments. So any situation that requires more than a 20 second explanation, that the brain is conditioned to not be able to process that. Okay, so this is one of the reasons. Other than this show, I don't do public appearances. I don't go on television. I don't go out and go on the speaking tours, because I think we as a culture, and it's not people's fault. It's like I said, a process of the education system, media, vitamin deficiencies, having to work, two jobs to make ends meet, so they don't even have time to sit down and read a book, even if they wanted to. They have all these things have sort of coalesced to produce a situation where I don't know that people are necessarily able to understand some of this stuff, and they're being assaulted with electronic propaganda on a 24/7 basis. It's not that I think I'm smarter than them. What I do have is I do have a very fast reading comprehension ability, and that was honed through things like going to law school. So I've been able to sit and do a lot of reading over the last 5 to 6 years to come to understand this stuff. So it's not a matter of being that I think I'm more intelligent. What I have had is the luxury of being able to go through a lot of material and the privilege of having an educational background where you can actually, connect the dots. And most people haven't had either one of those privileges.
East of the Rockies, Patty is in Knoxville, Tennessee for Matt Savinar on Coast to Coast. Patty?
Hi, Ian. How are you tonight?
Terrific. Thank you. Here's Matt.
Matt, from what you're saying to everyone, you appear to be rather condescending to the majority of people in the United States, thinking that we do not have time enough to sit down and read a book or comprehend what you're trying to tell us. I don't think that that's truly the case for the majority of people. I think that people are busy. I think that they are preoccupied with the struggle of day-to-day living. But I don't think that you should be so condescending and so accusatory that everyone cannot be, let's say, to your level of understanding. I think that if you talk to people directly, that they would understand exactly what you're saying.
Well, actually, I spent 3 to 4 years giving public talks about this stuff, coming on Coast to Coast and other shows until I, stopped doing those. And in my experience, the vast majority of people would react to what I would present. I'd present in a very calm, professional way. They'd say, well, this is just a big conspiracy. I don't believe it. And what you said, I had just said what you said 2 minutes before Ian took the call, which is that it's not that people are – so maybe I shouldn't say that they're so dumb. It's that they've been conditioned to look at things in 30-second segments. And like you said, they're now working two jobs to make ends meet. So they don't have the time to sit down and read, two, three, four, five books to try to get an understanding of this type of stuff. I mean, it's hard enough just to figure out what to do with your 401k if you even have a 401k. So I don't. It's a combination. It's not that I'm accusing them, but I mean, if you look at any of the studies, I mean, I think there was a study recently, 25% of, or like something like most, even most congressmen don't know the difference between a Shia and a Sunni. And those are congressmen, most of whom are also attorneys. Okay? So if Congress, who's voting for a war, doesn't know for the most part the difference between Sunni and Shia, and they're spending, 50 times as much time on the steroid issues as they were trying to figure out what a Shia was versus what a Sunni is, then I have trouble believing that the people they represent are any more informed.
Let's get to Jim in Grand Junction, Colorado for Matt Savinar on Coast to Coast AM. Jim?
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Talking to Matt. Go ahead.
I do know this. I live right here close to the oil shale, and then they've been doing a tremendous amount of oil drilling. They've discovered a lot of new reserves here, but in the Buckcliff Range that runs from Rifle all the way through the Grand Valley and all the way out into Utah for hundreds of miles, that is full of oil shale, and they say that'll last 250 years. And that's about all I wanted to say right there. Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you actually go, you just Google that Bakken oil shale, the people who are actually there, the optimists, say it maybe is going to produce 250,000 barrels a day. World uses 85 million barrels a day. Thing with oil shale, it's not really oil. It's basically like a hard rock, and you have to burn through a tremendous amount of energy and fresh water. So much fresh water that back in the 70s or 80s, one of the oil companies, I don't remember which one, but one of the majors actually proposed rerouting the Mississippi River into Colorado, rerouting it so they could have enough fresh water to extract the oil from the shale. So, again, this is another one of what I was talking about, when you have a culture that is addicted to something and doesn't want to come to grips with it, they'll grasp at all these sort of straws rather than deal with the reality.
Let's get to Tony in Orange, California, on Coast to Coast AM for Matt Savinar. Tony?
Yes, Matt, I hope you don't think this is a stupid question. They say that we are a consumer economy. I wanted to know if what the gas price is going up over the last year or so, did that take away disposable income, which caused us to go into this depression or recession?
But yeah, that's not a stupid question at all. That's actually a very intelligent question, in that it can, what you just did, you connected the connection between energy, the energy prices that were shooting up from mid 2007 into July of 2008, and then the mortgage meltdown that really it had already been occurring prior to that, but it really kicked into high gear. And so the most immediate proximate cause of that was the dramatic increase in food and fuel prices. Now, eventually the mortgage bubble was going to pop, even if oil prices had stayed at a more reasonable level. But that was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. And so, yes, there absolutely was a connection between the run-up in prices and then the collapse of the mortgage bubble, which then led to the credit crisis and all the fallout that has occurred since then.
Carlos in Carson City, California, for Matt Savinar on Coast to Coast. Carlos?
Matt, what would happen, Matt, if the Middle Eastern ever-producing countries decided to decelerate the production of oil and perhaps even shut down the Strait of Hormuz in response to the abomination that's taking place in the Gaza Strip by the Israelis, and of course, and as a reprisal to the United States, who unconditionally supports the Israelis? What would happen to the price of oil if that occurred?
In the Strait of Hormuz, I forget off the top of my head exactly how much oil is brought through there, but it's a tremendous amount and a tremendous percentage of overall global supply and of what comes into the U.S. So if that was shut down, you'd see it shoot back up. And, it would create a panic-type scenario. And so the price would shoot up. And, from there, what happens from there, I don't know. But the results would be not good.
And so looking ahead, again, in 2009, you think gas prices at the pump are going to be fairly stable?
It could go. Like I said at the top, it could go down to 25, and then it could shoot back up to 200.
No, I was just going to, at the pump. So at what point do you think
That would be like a dollar, it could shoot down to a dollar and then shoot back up to 750.
And when do you think, what would be the, if you had to think about some of the triggers for that, what would shoot it up? What would we be looking for signs that it's about to start going back up again?
Well, it could be like the Strait of, like the gentleman just said, the Strait of Hormuz shutting down. It could be if the decline, if Mexico stops exporting, which they said they're going to have to do within a couple of years, that would cut off a significant percentage because their production is dropping. So there's all sorts of things that could do that. It just depends on how many people still have jobs to drive to. If the unemployment rate, which the government says it's 8.5, it's probably more like 16 or 17. That shoots up to 20 or 24, then that's going to drive the price back down. But then if you get a production decline of 9%, right, it will shoot back up. And then you get this whipsaw effect. It's actually worse than if the price would just stay high.
We'll keep an eye on that with lifeafterTheOilCrash.net. You can link up to Matt Savinar through coasttocoastam.com. Well, maybe the natural people can help. We'll talk about that next on Coast to Coast.